who serves as a Williams Bay council member. And also, in his other life, is a docent with both the Field Museum, very active with history matters with the Williams Bay Historical Foundation. And we're just going to talk about a potpourri of history and politics and all the interesting things that make southeastern Wisconsin the interesting area to live and visit and study and research. And Greg, welcome back.
Well, it's glad to be here, Jim.
Now, Greg, first of all, the most immediate thing this summer, people who are returning to the area are seeing posters all over that say, visit prehistoric Williams Bay. Now, Williams Bay is known for a lot of things, but it's not necessarily known for being prehistoric. What's that all about?
Well, you know what? I've been here for 10 years, and about 3 years ago, two or three years ago, when I got the idea, and many people in the community wanted to be part of it, to put together an exhibit here at the library on the history of Williams Bay. And just talking to people, including Ann Becker, who just recently retired as our head librarian here in Williams Bay, started to throw out things that I never knew of, such as that a mastodon skeleton had been dug up here in 1907, or that this entire area was an area sacred to the Potawatomi Indians. And so we started to sort of dig up this material. But one thing that came to my attention recently, now I remember how it all took place. Last year I went into the fifth grade, and I was talking about what's new with dinosaurs. But really it was just a talk on what's new in discoveries on prehistoric animals. And one of the boys in the class at the end said, you know what, my mom has a nice collection of fossils. So I looked at her fossils, plus some other people, have a lot of fossils of marine animals. And, you know, first glance was, well, maybe Lake Geneva overflowed its banks 1,000 years ago, and, you know, these are some shells of creatures. But I showed a couple to some people around here, Dr. Joyce from Kenosha Museum, and we'll talk about him a little bit later on, but I showed a couple of these fossils to him, and particularly I showed them to Mr. Richard Dreiser, who works at Yerkes Museum, but one of his side avocations is rock collecting. He really knows how to identify fossils in rocks. And it turns out that these fossil marine animals are actually about 400 million years old. That's right, about three times or twice as old as any dinosaur. And years ago, where eastern Wisconsin is now, was all part of a shallow sea. It was warm and tropical, and there was a huge reef system that went all the way through eastern Wisconsin down to Chicago. And this is 400 to 500 million years old. And so these fossilized remains are the sea creatures that lived here in the, along the reef. And why the fossils are so close is that when the glaciers during the Ice Age, the last 3 million years, when they came back and forth, they were like giant bulldozers, and they wiped out all the rock material older than 20,000 years ago, because that was the last glacial advance in this area. And they bulldozed all the rocks out until maybe about 400 million years ago. So if you're digging here, you might find Indian artifacts. And we have those on display here in our special display case during the summer at the Village Hall. So you have Indian artifacts, and under that you may have Ice Age material from when mammoths and mastodons were here. And all of a sudden, right underneath that are the remains of this ancient sea 400 million years ago. So people will find these fossils if a house is excavated next door, or on a farm field, or going down to the shore in Cedar Point. These fossils are not that far down. They're very accessible. And I don't think people really know, by and large, what they are or how old they are. So we've got it in a display case over at Village Hall this summer. On the first shelf are Indian artifacts. Indians were, or Native Americans, have been in this area anywhere from about the last 14,000 years. Mr. Pete Ullman, who doesn't live too far away, is an archaeologist in this area, and most of the artifacts on display are from him, and also Miss Maggie Gage of Gage Marine also had a nice, very nice Indian artifact that's been a family heirloom for many years, and she lent it to us. And then on the bottom shelf are all these marine fossils from this ancient sea, before the time of dinosaurs. The first big rock, which shows remains of coral, was from a Miss Regina Martin, retrieved it when some excavation was being done next to her house. And all the other fossils on display there are from what kids from the fourth and fifth grade donated to me. And they really are the bulk of our ancient marine fossil collection that we're showing this summer.
Now, was this area, in essence, kind of a western area of what was the Atlantic Ocean? Did this, how far did this ocean extend?
I think this is way before Atlantic and Pacific Ocean. What was now land was submerged and under sea, and what was under the sea, maybe the mountains today. There's been so many bodies of water that have come in, come down. For example, Kansas is a very dry area, but in dinosaur times, there was actually part of a very shallow sea. What the shallow sea was called that was here 400 million years ago, I don't know.
And I know that this area at one point was the southern end of what is now Green Bay. The Green Bay, the body of water, extended all the way down to where Williams Bay is.
Yeah, well, that was called particularly the Green Bay Ice Show Advance. And now we're jumping to the Ice Age. The last 3 million years during the Ice Ages, glaciers would develop and move southward all the way to the middle of the United States. And the last advance is called the Wisconsin Ice Age. Called the Wisconsin Ice Age because so many great remnants of that for a soil that was dug up or moraines and are found here in Wisconsin. And where we were, where we are here, Lake Geneva, we presume, was part of a glacier. And the farthest the glacier in this area got is the southern tip of the lake, which is why around Fontana there is so hilly and so many resorts want to be there. And they're building new residential developments called on the cliffs of Fontana. Well, that's because that's the farthest that 20,000 years ago, roughly, the glaciers that were moving in this direction, this is as far as they got. And you can tell that because if you drive down 67 and you go through the Fontana area, it's very hilly. And then as soon as you go under the railroad tracks and you go into Walworth, it's very flat. And you're back in the flat Midwest farm that we all know and enjoy, which means that that's as far as the glacier that was this area got was the southern tip of the lake. Which means, again, the remains that you have here, the last glacial advance was 20,000 years ago, roughly, which means that all the rock that was older than that was scrubbed out, eliminated. You will never find a dinosaur bone in Wisconsin. Sorry, kids, because the glaciers went back and forth and eliminated that. But then what's right underneath that Ice Age material, you're getting into the time of this ancient marine sea from 400 million years ago.
And, you know, you mentioned Kenosha. Certainly they have a wonderful museum where you can see some prehistoric large creatures, but we've had them here in Williams Bay and not too far from where we're recording this at the public library.
Well, when you dig up material like that, Ice Age material, you have to keep it at a museum that has a full-time curator. Those are state rules. Kenosha is fortunate enough to have a full-time curator, and that's why They have this wonderful mammoth there. I think that was found on the Schaefer farm. And this mammoth was the first elephant east of the Mississippi River that was found with Indian butcher marks on it, knife marks on bone. So we know conclusively that the Indians presumably brought the animal down, although I suppose they could have come across one that had just died. But in any case, they were butchering the animal for food.
And but one was found near where the elementary school is?
Yes.
No?
There is a book called The Book of Lake Geneva, and it was written by a local scientist, I think Paul Burrell Jenkins. There's a copy of the book in the Williams Bay Library, as well as you can – the book is online. It's a free U.S. Congress publication now. Anyway, he writes – Dr. Jenkins – I presume he's a doctor, but Mr. Jenkins wrote – that in 1907, a farmer by the name of Michael Johnston was digging in his garden, and he came across mastodon bones. And, of course, he just dug them out. Now, in paleontology, study of prehistoric animals, oftentimes this is true with dinosaur bones, but this is true even much more recent bones, you have to somehow reinforce the bones, insert some sort of glue or some sort of preserve that'll make it tougher, because if you just dig the bones out, they might all deteriorate. And that's what happened to these mastodon bones, with the exception of the teeth. The teeth are very solid. And there's a publication wrote in 1930 by Paul Burrell Jenkins talking about those teeth being in the Geneva Lake Museum. Well, they are no longer in the Geneva Lake Museum. And what seems to have happened is the State Archaeological Office maintains that any Ice Age materials has to be held at a place which has a full-time curator. So, interesting, Mr. Jenkins writes that most of the mastodon skeletons found in this area were missing their tusks. So I ask you, who took the tusk? And the presumption must be probably the first generations of Native Americans who reached this area.
Now, the elementary school is closing after 100 years to be replaced. And as I understand it, this is a unique time period where you can go and do some more searching, and people will be, to see what can be found of prehistoric Williams Bay.
Well, what happened is last year, Ms. Phyllis Janda and I were giving a presentation to the fourth grade on the history of Williams Bay. Fourth grade is because that's the year in the school that covers for the students what was like pioneer life. They generally take the kids out to Old World, Wisconsin. Hmm. So we thought it would be a good time to give that presentation. And I'm the guy who talks about the glaciers and the Ice Age stuff just before the Native Americans arrived here. And while I was digging through the material and looking over, you know, Paul Burrell Jenkins, I came across something that stated that was dug up on the Michael Johnston property. I knew that. But then I came across some reference to the Williams Bay Lutheran Church being built on the Michael Johnston property. That one was new. Well, that's what was new. I found that reference regarding the founding of the Williams Bay Lutheran Church, which means if that was on the Michael Johnston property, the Michael Johnston property was right across the street from the elementary. So then I saw Dr. Wayne Anderson, who's our current school superintendent here in Williams Bay, and I mentioned it to him. And I said, gee, wouldn't it be neat, particularly with the elementary school closing the next year, which, of course, now is this year, 2016, to have some sort of survey done on the land around here to see if there was any other Indian or Ice Age materials. And Dr. Anderson was very supportive of the idea. Well, I'm a docent with the Field Museum, so I sent out emails to two professors that I had heard of, basically saying, well, how do you look for mastodon bones? And the one who responded was Dr. Dan Joyce from the Kenosha Museum. I had talked to him once before when we had the Williams Bay History Exhibit here, and I was just getting some background on information on mammoths and mastodons. I called him, and he was kind enough to respond and give me some information. Well, he was the one who responded. In fact, he was so interested in the site that he came out twice last summer to look at it, once in June by himself and the second time on Labor Day, and he was here with two colleagues. So they developed a proposal that they sent to the superintendent, proposing that they would like to do a survey of the land around the current building on Congress Street, because that's the land. So they're not interested on the ground that the elementary school is standing on. They're interested in the field and stuff around it that has not been disturbed. They think there's a very good chance that there will be Indian material here. Again, all the area by the lake was an area that was fairly sacred to the Potawatomi Indians. And also because of the discovery of the mastodon, the possibility that there might be some Ice Age materials to look at as well. So that is... And that was approved. I've been told Dr. Joyce emailed me that he just got the state archaeological permit so that weekends this summer you may see three scientists out there doing some survey work, and we'll all be interested to see what they come up with.
So it won't be giant excavators, but specialized equipment that looks under the surface?
You know, some will be X-ray equipment. Some will be sifting the soil, and that will sometimes give you an indicator if there's probability of material underneath. Now, if you do find something, then at that particular site you would do a deeper excavation. But this is just, you know, exploratory. Again, because of the fact that this was the Potawatomi were in the area, we're reasonably think there's a fair chance that you are going to find some material from their period. Now, if you go out to where the elementary school is and follow it down Congress Street, you'll see that the ground starts to dip. And as you walk, you're definitely walking downhill where you're walking down to Walworth Avenue. So it doesn't take that much of imagination to see at a time when the glaciers had just melted, there's a decent chance that the lakefront went farther up, and that where the elementary school now is at one point could have been the lakefront. And I think the interesting thing would see is whether you have a record of a long-term Indian occupation site. So we know the Potawatomi were here the last 300, 400 years before the European settlers started to arrive. Was this potentially, because of the close proximity to the lake, a long-term Indian occupation site, Native American occupation? So you would have find remains of many tribes that successively were in this area. And that would be very fascinating to find out. And then, of course, at the bottom of all this is there any additional Ice Age material here?
Now, we kind of know when the Indian occupation period ends. One of the remarkable things people can see while they're in town is on Elm Street, not too far from the library here, there is a stone that speaks to a unique burial of a unique citizen.
Right, and that is Potawatomi Woman, which was one of the wives of Chief Bigfoot, who was the last chief here. And the Potawatomi Indians, show you just a very different outlook on things. When they're dead, deceased, died, rather than burying them in the ground, which we typically do today, they would expose them on platforms and let the bodies peacefully compose into nature. And the winter before the chief had to leave because of orders from the federal government, this was during the administration of President Andrew Jackson, which had the effect of ordering all the Indian tribes that they had to move west of the Mississippi River. Well, the winter before, Chief Bigfoot lost, I believe, at least two of his wives and some of his children. And so the wives were buried on that site there on Elm Street. And the children, for the Potawatomi, they would bury them up in the trees. And in fact, one of his sons had a love of the lake, and they buried him, his body, in a tree overlooking the lake. And the story goes that when the, you know, federal authorities showed up, and this is for real, you're going to have to move, Captain Israel Williams was already here and had developed a good relationship with the chief. And the chief asked if he would, you know, take care of that burial ground. And he promised he would. But our assumption is that as soon as the chief left, he saw to the burial ground, but as he understood it, which was to give the, you know, to bury the bodies in the ground. And that just shows us such a very different outlook on life. Another thing is we have a record, I think, of Captain Williams filing a claim with whatever, the county of Walworth or whatever that was here back then, asking that it be understood that he owned a certain amount of land in this area. And that's totally alien to how the Indians would have saw it, that they didn't understand the concept. Any privately owning land was just something that they didn't have. It was something that, you know, everybody held sort of in common, and whoever was using it. So that time, 1836-37, is a very critical time in a change of just how different human habitation is before and after. And I think that little plot that's owned by the Potawatomi Indians that commemorates that the Potawatomi woman was buried there is really a magic spot here in Williams Bay, and it's sort of the end of the exclusive Indian culture, the Indian culture that had held sway here since the end of, since the passing of the Mastodon so many thousands of years earlier.
You're listening to Greg Trush, village councilman and archaeology history expert here in Williams Bay, and Community Matters. We're talking about the unique history of this area in which we live. You're listening to WGTD in Elkhorn on 101.7 FM, in Lake Geneva on 103.3, and in Kenosha Racine 103.3 FM on the internet, WGTD.org. WGTD is your gateway to NPR news, music, all in the world. And Greg Trush, in our world here in Williams Bay, we were just talking about the Potawatomi Indians here, one of the last wives of Chief Bigfoot buried in the trees on Elm Street.
Yeah, now, she was actually buried on a platform. It was the children that, if necessary, they would hollow out some, and they would put the children, I forget whether it was in bundles or whatever, up in the trees. And that's how this group of Indians did it. And so it's a peaceful kind of communing back into nature. I think there's other cultures you will see the same thing. But it's very different from the settler period afterwards, where you don't take up good space above ground, you know, that we bury them and whatever, and then we utilize the ground for, you know, commercial purposes. You just see such a difference in viewpoint when that transition takes place.
You mentioned Captain Israel Williams, who, you know, generally regarded as the founder of Williams Bay, certainly named for it. Now, he was an 1812...
He was, I believe, a captain or in the War of 1812, but he doesn't get here until sometime in the 1830s. In fact, I think the first recording of a white settler actually officially saying, "I found Lake Geneva," Geneva Lake, was John Kinsey, who was very famous in the times of early Chicago, and he and his wife record coming up here around 1830 and finding Geneva Lake. And it's amazing how everything happens. It's just a short period of time. If you drive through the village of Bigfoot, which is actually on the state line between Illinois and Wisconsin, on the Illinois side, you'll see the cemetery there says founded 1840. So in the 1820s, as far as we know, there were no white settlers up here. Then all of a sudden, they start coming up here in the 1830s. The Indians are forced to leave in 36, 37. And then all these little towns that we're so familiar with, I think if you check, you'll find are founded within a short period of time. And now here, basically 180 years later, such an enormous change, you know. The population that we, but it, or it really didn't start in this area until about 180 years ago. So if you calculate every generation, 30 years, so six generations, you would have had just Indian culture here. And that probably an occasional fur trapper, something that had been going on here since the French period or something. But no real, white European settler communities here until that time. And all of a sudden, they mushroom all over the place.
And with the issues recently over whether Jackson should be replaced on the $20 bill or not, and there's been a lot of talk about the Trail of Tears and forced relocation. But I don't think a lot of people realize that that affected our Native Indians right here in the Wisconsin area. We tend to think of, you know, Florida and Oklahoma and
right. And now, all the Indians were ordered out of here, and I guess the story that I was told by some of our members of the Historical Society was, or that I read somewhere, is he did go to the local convention that the Indian chiefs had been invited to a meeting with federal authorities where they were told, oh, we're going to take, this is going to be the greatest places that you're going to be going to west of the Mississippi River. He didn't sign that treaty because he didn't particularly believe it. And when the, but when the federal authorities arrived here in 1836, said this is for real, you have to leave, he decided not to fight it. And who knows? One thing that the Native Americans sometimes saw in signs or things that happen, signs saying it's time to move on. We do know that the winter before he had lost so many family members. Is it possible he took that as a sign that he shouldn't fight this? The reason why I note that is that in much of the Americas, you find that, for example, when environmental conditions would change, all of a sudden Native Americans would leave even very well-established cities and stuff that had been established down in Mesoamerica or whatever. All of a sudden, the city is abandoned, and they decide to move on. Could something similar have been occurring up here that the chief just didn't think it was worth fighting? The story is, and if you look at the statue of Bigfoot that they have in front of the Bigfoot High School in Walworth, it shows a very tearful chief because he's looking on his lake for the last time. And when they did move these people out to Kansas and stuff, they found out that these little rivers and stuff that they were promising them, it was nothing like the lakes. It was a very raw deal. But yes, it's my understanding now we still have the Chippewa Indians up in Chippewa Flow. Somebody told me that they came back, they were allowed back, but that everybody here at that time in the 1830s was a forced relocation here.
And by the 1890s, you know, Wisconsin has become a state.
I think the state, 1838.
1838, yeah. And descendants of those first settlers were now settling the area, and the folks that would build the Yerkes Observatory in the 1890s showed up in Williams Bay.
Right, and that was, I think the University of Chicago had built some sort of observatory building. But they concluded that it wasn't really, so being on a big lake by a rapidly expanding city where you're having a lot of illumination was not a good site for an observatory. And of course, remember that after the Chicago Fire of 1870-71, a lot of Chicagoans at least temporarily relocated themselves up to the Lake Geneva area and knew how nice it was. And so the decision was made to bring the observatory up here.
One legacy of having an observatory in our area is part of a relatively new movement for what's called the Dark Sky Initiative.
Mm-hmm.
And wearing your village council councilman hat, I know that you've taken an interest in some new lighting projects in the city that are encompassing that effort to try and cut down on light pollution.
Right. How that all came about, I think it was last fall was the first night game for our football team, and my wife and I were at the game with my daughter, who's still at the high school, and we saw two of her very close friends that we've known since kindergarten. We offered the girls a ride home, and they said, no, we're going to walk. Well, big girls, that's fine. And my wife turned our car down Theater Road, and then all of a sudden we saw these girls on the side of the road, and there is lighting just at where the road turns, like into, I live in Baywood Heights, and the road, the turnoff off of Theater is Sunset Boulevard, so there's a light right there on 67 and Theater, then Sunset Boulevard, then down at Lakewood Trails Road, which means, and because it is heavily forested, and people do tend to walk in what is the bicycle trail on the east side of Theater Road, the illumination is not the greatest at night. So I rose the question with the trustees whether we should seek to get put up some additional street lights to kind of break those black areas between the lights here. And they agreed, and I went to the town of Walworth, who actually owns the land on the east side of Theater Road as part of Walworth, the town of Walworth.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a member of their board who is also on the Yerkes board and says, we should really check with Yerkes. So I talked to Jim G. from Yerkes, and they were very supportive of the idea, saw the need for the lights. They asked, however, would you please use, 100-watt lights instead of your proposed 150, and also see that they were energy efficient. And we were more than happy to agree to that. Also, the new lights, like the other lights in theater, have hoods on them so that the light is directly downwards and not diffused outward. And I went over to Yerkes and attended a meeting of the Dark Sky Initiative. And they very much wanted to kind of highlight what we were doing here in Williams Bay, because it was a case of a municipality following the guidelines of the Dark Sky Initiative, which is there's a need in different places and times for illumination, but you can also do it in an energy efficient way that you're not causing undue light pollution. In other words, some people to provide light at night, have such high degree of illumination that it's really overkill, like you can read a whole newspaper the outside, and that may be attractive, but you're also to some people, but that's also a lot of extra light. And for people who like studying the stars at night and kind of communicating with nature, I think what the Dark Skies Initiative is to find that balance between respecting the need, obviously, for illumination in some places for safety, but yet make it proportional so people can still enjoy nature, see the stars at night. And for what they're doing in Yerkes, keeping unnecessary illumination at night. And I think most people, when you come out to Williams Bay, obviously you want to see what you're going, but I found it very restful. Like when I was walking the dog out and had to go outside and basically seeing the stars and not, an overuse of artificial light at night.
It really is a remarkable part about living in this area, about just how bright our stars are here, and the planets, and the colors that you can see. It's really a unique part of being a Southeast Wisconsin resident, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it's remarkable because, like, we're 100 miles from Chicago and I don't know what from Milwaukee. And so you can have the benefits of both worlds. You're in a small town where you can go out and enjoy nature. You can go out to Kishwaukato, be on our lake, and walk down a street and look at the stars at night. And at the same time, you know, if you need to be in Chicago and Milwaukee, you could do it, in an hour, 2 hours, either by car or by train.
Kishwaukato is our nature preserve, mm-hmm. which is right adjacent to the bay and Geneva Lake. How did we end up with that resource in the area here?
Okay, there are people who could be more precise than I am. However, about 30, 40 years ago, there were developers who were interested in developing it, small airport, resort, golf course. And I think it became before the village board maybe about 30 years ago.
I know they just recently celebrated their 25th anniversary of the preserve.
Okay, so maybe
itself.
It was 25, 30 years ago. Yeah. And the people on the board at that time, Todd Lothian, who recently passed, Harold Freestand, who is the president of the Conservancy now, he was the board president at the time, and they're looking at all these proposals to develop, and it made them really think whether they wouldn't be better off preserving it as a natural resource for the people, for everyone in the area, plus our visitors. So they kind of took what was probably an unusual decision as opposed to just trying to get a quick profit to preserve the area. Now, that's also been very important in preserving the lake quality of the lake, I understand, because it allows for natural water runoff and whatever. Had you just bricked that up and all sorts of commercial uses, the lake would not be of the quality it is today.
We talk about the lakefront and its resources. Of course, one of the best parts about it is the fact that you can walk the lake for 20, 21 miles, that
yeah.
it's a free area. And doesn't that roughly translate back to an agreement that the Indians had, that it would be their way to get around the shore? Or?
You know, that I don't know where it comes from, but I think, you know, the joy of communicating with nature is something that pulls people out to Lake Geneva area. But if you couldn't go from one lot to the other because I own this and whatever, so for whatever reason, the tradition was established that every property owner must allow a small pathway to come through here. Now, you know, many of the people who have property anywhere, you know, are very protective of their privacy or whatever. But I think people in this area have certainly gone along with the idea that we want to share this with people who just want to walk on by. And it works very well. It helps draw people to our area. And then also, if you take the tour, besides the nature, you get to look at all the various habitats, humble and not so humble, that people built on the lake, and that's just a great attraction.
Williams Bay is going to be more of a destination this summer, as this month marks the return of entertainment at the Belfry Theater, where mm-hmm. so many people in the 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s got their start, including Paul Newman and Harrison Ford, famous Gary Berghoff, Radar O'Reilly, who grew up in Delavan, also performed there. Williams Bay has the nickname of Bayberry by some residents for having that unchanging Mayberry characteristic. But there's been some changes. For instance, the modernization since we last talked on this show, Greg, there was new signage, new walkways, flashing lights and such added along 67. There's some progress coming to town, which I assume is proved to be for the better. At first, people were concerned about construction noise and stuff, but how are some of the more modern things working out for the area?
Well, I think we've got to consider ourselves to be very fortunate that we got the road improvements when we did. You know, a number of, maybe about 5 years ago, I had just gone on the village board, and we were reviewing plans by the state to resurface 50, and it went up to where the Geneva Street exit is, which is an important entranceway into our town. And then last summer, the state resurfaced 67 from Geneva to Theater Road. And that was very important because, frankly, bad potholes were developing. It was a resurfacing, not a full reconstruction. But I can tell you, as of today, it's still in great shape. And, of course, we know right now the state has some issues with, you know, funding and just to make everything kind of balance. Some projects are being put off, so we consider ourselves very fortunate that the state did that we got the resurfacing in last summer. We're very appreciative. It did not cost the municipality anything. And the improvement to our downtown areas, these are the type of improvements that you have to make occasionally. You just can't get out of, not improvements, but it's like changing the roof on your house. You know, it just has to be done. And, you know, there's little inconveniences. We didn't have to block the road permanently in both directions at any time. You will have to do that when you get to a reconstruction, but that's probably, you know, a good 10 years from now. So,
and then,
don't worry about it.
Right. And Interstate 43, just 5 miles to the north of us, which is kind of almost a direct highway to Milwaukee, 40 mm-hmm. minutes away, added stoplights. At that intersection, I assume, has added a little more safety to the area.
Right.
In the 2 minutes or so we have left, let's recap again the fact that you have been instrumental in creating a Williams Bay prehistoric exhibit. How do people get there, and what do they see when they get there?
Well, it's very simple to get there. You have to go to Village Hall to get your beach permit or anything else. And at the end of the main hall, just before you enter the council chambers, is a display case that when we had this History of Williams Bay exhibit about 2 years ago, President John Marr, village president, was able to get that donated by one of the exhibitors of a jewelry store or something in our village who didn't need it anymore. And it was decided to keep that for a formal display case. And it is run by the Williams Bay Historical Society. And they change the exhibits periodically. And I asked them if for a few months this year I could put something in there about the prehistoric history of Williams Bay, both the Indian cultures that were here and as well as these ancient marine fossils. And they were happy to give me the space for a couple months.
And that'll be running through the end of the summer?
I would say so, around August or something. I think you want to keep it fresh. You just don't want a display that just sits there and never changes, because then after time people don't, you know, pay it any heed. So, but I think for the summer, as I said, some of the students from the fourth and fifth grade were very generous in providing me with their fossils. So we have it out there so that when mom and dad comes in to get the beach permit, they can drag them down and say, hey, there's my fossil, and this is what it's all about.
Well, Greg Truss, is always a pleasure to be with you, and I want to thank you for being on Community Matters. You really are I don't know if Renaissance man is the term, since you deal with so many historic things, but between your involvement in government, your involvement with the history, and I know you're also the Colonel Clank of the lunchroom.
Yes, lunchrooms, they never get anything past me. No, the truth is everybody else, including the ladies of the cook, are probably tougher than I am, but we do keep some sort of sense of order there, and it's very enjoyable working with the kids.
So. Well, thanks again for joining us on Community Matters.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
I'm Jim McClure. You've been listening to Community Matters on WGTD, and wishing you a very good and blessed afternoon. Take care.
You've been listening to Community Matters, a program that airs every Saturday morning at 11:15 on WGTD. For an online recording of today's show, log on to WGTD's website at WGTD.org, click Talk, and go to Community Matters. Your gateway to public radio is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva.
WGTD broadcasts from studios located on the Kenosha campus of Gateway Technical College. In Kenosha and Racine, WGTD is heard at